Lecture 21, Spies in Fiction and Film.
It is winter in Jamaica, February 1952. A British journalist, on vacation at his second home in the tropics, is writing at a portable typewriter. He is 44 years old. He is surrounded by the swirling fumes of cigarettes and the high-octane cocktails which he favors. Over 1 month, this writer crafts a story that introduces the most famous spy of all time. The spy is a compelling character, a composite of many different inspiring people that the writer had known, especially during the adventurous years of the Second World War. Even today, that character's fame grows and grows even after his creator's passing. The writer is Ian Fleming, and his creation is Agent 007, Bond, James Bond. In this lecture, we will focus on the spies, who were the literary creations of men who had themselves been spies or were involved in intelligence work. We will compare and contrast Ian Fleming's super spy, James Bond, with the disenchanted, disillusioned spies of Graham Greene and Jean Le Carré. A fascinating question is how these authors' experiences were transmuted and reshaped in their fictional creations. These authors were not the first, nor are they likely to be the last, whose own espionage careers informed their literary production. The man who's considered first in this tradition actually wrote decades before the Cold War. He was the British author W. Somerset Maugham, who had been a British spy in the First World War. Because Maugham was physically handicapped with a club foot, he first enrolled in the ambulance corps of the British Army, but then was recruited by the British Secret Service in 1915. Maugham had a very suitable background. He was fluent in German and in French, and an excellent cover, because he was already a successful author. Maugham had just published in 1915 what has been considered his masterpiece and one of the greatest novels of the century, the semi-autobiographical novel Of Human Bondage. Maugham was dispatched to neutral Switzerland, where he observed enemy spies, working there for a year until he was sent on a special mission to Russia. A prolific writer, Maugham worked his wartime experiences up into a book entitled Ashenden, or The British Agent, published in 1928. And in the process, he actually agonized about whether even this fictionalized representation might be giving away too much of his secret experiences. This work, Ashenden, is a linked series of short stories, all of which feature the author's alter ego character, Ashenden, as a worldly, sophisticated, and very literate spy who interacts with fantastical and sinister characters in his work. These include a man named the Hairless Mexican, who besides being a monstrous egomaniac, is also a ruthless assassin, although a feckless one, for he kills the wrong man at the start of the book. In Ashenden, Maugham emphasized the boring routine nature of most intelligence work, but then went on to relate stirring examples of intrigue anyhow, as well as the morally questionable aspects of espionage. In the preface to the book, Maugham wrote, quote, "The work of an agent in the intelligence department is on the whole extremely monotonous. A lot of it is uncommonly useless." But then Maugham hastened to add, "But there will always be espionage, and there will always be counter-espionage." In a harrowing example of the troubled morality of secret warfare, for instance, in the book, Ashenden confers with one of his own agents, a Pole. Together, he and Ashenden are planning to blow up munitions factories in Austria. It's a good plan, with the drawback, obviously, that it will kill many Polish workers. The Polish agent is willing, nonetheless, to go through with the plan if it is essential, if it'll help win the war, but only if it is essential. As the Polish agent says, quote, "We don't want to sacrifice our own people for nothing," end quote. Ashenden is struck by the logic of the situation in which this is seen as a legitimate act of war, even though it's directed at civilians, at men not in uniform. But yet they're playing an important wartime role by producing munitions. Finally, as Ashenden and his Polish agent argue back and forth about whether to go forward or not, they can't decide. And they finally decide to flip a coin to determine the result, whether the operation goes forward or not. And the coin is flipped, and just to be especially ironic, and to underline the randomness of human suffering and action, Mom does not even tell his readers what decision the coin brought. We simply hear Ashenden saying, "Well, that's that." The ironic and suave gentleman spy Ashenden is sometimes identified by later scholars as one of the inspirations for the later creation of James Bond. But there are significant contrasts, for Ashenden is shy and often prefers an evening with a book to glamorous nightlife. Also, in considering the literary spies of Fleming, Greene, and Le Carré, one must also bear in mind what's not always obvious in an explicit way in these stories, but in fact is indispensable background to these literary creations, and that's the experience of the Second World War. All three authors served in the war, or in the case of Le Carré, just after the war, in intelligence roles, and the war left a lasting impression. We've already discussed in earlier lectures the lead-up to the war and espionage during the war, but here we should mention the literary dimension of Europe's descent into a new total war. A master of the spy thriller who was active just as the war was beginning was Eric Ambler, a British author. His novel, A Coffin for Demetrios, was published in 1939, just as the war broke out. That, by the way, is the American title. In Britain, it was The Mask of Demetrios. Search me as to why it would be necessary to have different titles in precisely this fashion. This novel, A Coffin for Demetrios, was credited with introducing a new realism and hardness to the spy thriller, in part by changing the protagonist of the novel from a heroic gentleman spy to that of an ordinary civilian person of no particular conspicuous ability or daring, who suddenly finds himself dropped into unsuspected dangers, entanglements, and challenges, ones that he must rise to. You'll note that this formula already had been used to an extent by John Buchan, whom we discussed when we mentioned the literary production around the First World War. In Ambler's novel, a thriller writer named Charles Latimer, who is vacationing in Istanbul in Turkey, idly, simply to have something to do, investigates the death of a criminal and discovers that nothing about that death is as it seems, and that, in fact, that criminal, Demetrios, is not even dead, and, in fact, there are massive international conspiracies involved in his alleged demise, and now Latimer is involved and must somehow get himself untangled. Ambler's work was very influential, and indeed has inspired some of the best spy fiction of our own time by the author Alan First. First is an American writer whose wonderful novels, written from the late 1980s to the present day, are set in the period just before World War II or during the war itself. I recommend them in the very strongest terms for their masterful evocation of this time of despair and desperate choices. In particular, I would recommend his novel Dark Star. In this book, the protagonist is an agent in the 1930s working for the Soviet NKVD during the period of the Stalinist purges. And this agent is torn between multiple identities and the demands made on him by those different loyalties. This is a marvelous and effective rendering of the kinds of interwar choices that people had to make in a hyper-ideological age, the kind of things we talked about in our lecture on converts to espionage. Another novel that I would also especially urge you to read is entitled The Polish Officer, and it's set during the war. It's about a Polish intelligence officer who, after the defeat of Poland, smuggles the nation's gold reserves out of the country and then is active in the world of espionage in all of occupied Europe, working in Paris, as well as the forests of Ukraine, to resist the Nazis. These are books I especially recommend, but you just can't go wrong because all of First's works are excellent. But we might pose the question, why should World War II loom so very large? One answer is provided by another thriller writer of our own times, Ken Follett. This British author has set many of his dynamic stories in the same epoch, including The Key to Rebecca and Eye of the Needle. Follett, I think, has a great part of the answer. He's argued that, simply put, World War II is the single most dramatic event that has ever happened in human history, in terms of just sheer scale, as well as moral impact, and for this reason affords the ideal backdrop to spy fiction. It's a compelling argument. Having considered these precursors, let us now move to discuss the most famous spy of all time. Ian Fleming's creation, James Bond, is one of the most recognizable brands in the world. In fact, it's been estimated in 2008 that half of the world population has seen a James Bond film. When I teach at the University of Tennessee and ask how many of my students have seen a Bond film, the entire class, without exception, will raise their hands. Bond is one of those characters, like Sherlock Holmes, who can seem vastly more real than many human beings we interact with daily. So powerful and complete a literary creation that he is. How did James Bond come into being? Ian Lancaster Fleming came from a privileged upper-class British background. He was born in 1908. Ian idolized his father, who was killed as an officer on the Western Front in 1917. Ian Fleming attended school at Eton, then the Royal Military Academy at Sandhurst. After being unable to gain entry into the Foreign Service as he had planned, Fleming tried his hand in the interwar years at journalism and later at being a stockbroker. He was remembered at the time as a ladies' man, a socialite, but not very successful in professional terms. Then, in 1939, just months before the war in Europe broke out, Fleming was recruited into naval intelligence. It's still not precisely clear how. Some sort of connections had come into play, perhaps social ones. Here, in naval intelligence, Fleming was tasked with crafting plans for covert missions, though he chafed at not being able to personally help in executing those plans. The plans that Fleming came up with included a plan for crash landing a plane disguised as a German aircraft into the English Channel, and then waiting for a German submarine to come to its rescue, and then overpowering the submarine in order to get the secret codes that the sub would carry. This brainchild was called Operation Ruthless. It ended up being shelved, however, because more sober minds pointed out, in reality, crash landing a plane into the English Channel would be likely to kill everyone on board rather than setting up the conditions for an effective ambush. Fleming also worked with commando forces, helping to plan their missions. After the war was over, Fleming went back to journalism, working as a foreign news manager for a group of British newspapers. This job allowed him vacations in Jamaica, where he began to write the first Bond novel in 1952. In 1953, this first Bond novel, Casino Royale, was published. In the story, the agent Bond is sent to beat and bankrupt an agent of the Soviets at the gambling tables of a fictional equivalent of Monte Carlo, but set in northern France, not in the south. In this mission, Bond becomes romantically involved with a fellow British female agent, the first of what came to be called the Bond Girls. But she turns out to be a double agent, reporting to the Soviets, and commits suicide over her moral position. This loss forecloses Bond's humanization, the emergence of a more permanent human relationship, which had appeared imminent in the plot. This novel was remade in movie form recently with Daniel Craig. The figure of Bond the super spy was rather different in the novels from the earlier films. Not a super handsome agent, but rather an empty tool trained to kill. Quote, "an anonymous blunt instrument wielded by a government department," end quote. In the first novel, Bond is described as having both warmth and humor, as well as being, quote, ironical, brutal, and cold, end quote. Who was James Bond? The name of this fictional character apparently came from the author of a bird-watching guide on the birds of Jamaica that Fleming had near his desk. But who is the model for Bond? That's a vexed question. And there's a splendid book written by Ben McIntyre entitled For Your Eyes Only, which examines this question of the literary inspirations for Bond in detail from every possible angle. Fleming avowed, personally, that Bond was not himself, except that obviously he must have been, because deep parts of Fleming's own character were brought to expression here. Fleming said that rather, the intelligence agents and commandos he had known in the Second World War were the true beginnings of James Bond. Other inspirations may have included the mysterious Sidney Reilly, the ace of spies whom we've mentioned in many lectures before. The Bond novels sold well. In fact, that's an understatement. By the time Fleming died in 1964, the James Bond books had sold more than 40 million copies worldwide. Now, reviewers were not uniformly complimentary. Some condemned the spy as a compound of sadism, adolescent sexual fantasy, and snobbery. But even if one conceded this, how could one account for the tremendous popularity of these books, which showed that Bond had struck some chord with many people? Well, first, there was the geopolitical context. Through Bond, Great Britain, in fictional form, was made into a great power once again, at a time when it was actually an imperial retreat. Another key subtext of the stories was the American-British tie, the so-called special relationship, which was said to bind these countries together, and which was invoked all the more frequently and urgently as the United States had displaced Britain's once dominant world role. It has also been argued that for British readers, admiring Bond's polish and style was a way of consoling themselves for the loss of empire, which was all too real. Felix Leiter, Bond's American CIA counterpart and colleague, was well-funded, but by comparison with Bond, unpolished, boorish, and unsophisticated. Bond also intersected with the Cold War history we've been discussing in our recent lectures, when the American President John F. Kennedy stated that he admired the Bond stories. This gave the books a huge marketing boost. Incidentally, but probably not surprisingly, Bond was not very popular in the communist countries. In fact, the Soviets were irked at not having a counterpart of their own to oppose Bond with. And a Bulgarian writer was actually commissioned to pen a novel where a communist super spy defeats James Bond. It probably goes without saying that this anti-James Bond has not achieved the same sort of immortality that the Bond stories have. They're not really a rival for him. I should also note that Fleming was also the author of another enduring popular character in children's stories. This time, the flying car, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And one could speculate that the flying car and the amazing technological weaponry of Bond have this in common, that they stress the role of modern science and technology in modern life. Then, for stark contrast with the dashing and daring of Agent 007, we should consider the famously disillusioned spies of Graham Greene and John le Carré. The world of these literary spies was one of moral equivalence between the opposing sides of the Cold War, all caught up in the sordid, dehumanizing, unworthy business of betrayal. Graham Greene was a British writer, author of many novels, who was also a former MI6 agent. His novels explored moral ambiguity. As a convert to Catholicism, many of his novels also confronted religious issues. Graham Greene was born in 1904 to the family of a schoolmaster. Greene attended Oxford and afterwards went into journalism and began writing novels. Greene managed in his novels to attract both a large popular audience and the praise of literary critics for the quality of his work. During the Second World War, Greene worked in MI6, where Kim Philby was his case officer or his handler and his friend. Indeed, years later, when Philby published his odd memoir, My Secret War, in 1968, Graham Greene was the one who wrote the preface to his book when it was published in Britain, calling it honest, well-written, and, quote, far more gripping than any novel of espionage, end quote. Indeed, Greene went on to call it a, quote, dignified statement of his beliefs and motives, end quote. Among Greene's many novels, I would like to focus here on one, which combines a dark kind of humor with deep disillusionment and skepticism. This is the 1958 novel Our Man in Havana, which presented spying as a senseless but tragic and cruel game. In the novel, a washed-up, middle-aged, despairing expatriate, British vacuum salesman named James Wormold is the hero, if that's exactly the word for the kind of character that Wormold represents. By misadventure and bureaucratic misunderstanding, Wormold, of all people, is recruited as a spy for MI6, who must have their own man in Havana on the spot. This is in the period, by the way, before Castro came to power. Given Wormold's declining economic fortunes, the task of spying is alluring. Wormold is unable to offload his inventory of so-called atomic pile vacuum cleaners. So he agrees to spy and becomes Agent 59200/5. But Wormold falls back on inventing a spy network with imaginary agents that he reports back on to London. Sometimes these agents that are really his own fictional creations are inspired or have the same names as people he's seen in Havana or knows remotely but doesn't really know personally. He also crafts an imaginary mission that he's accomplished, a mission of investigating mysterious military installations in the Cuban hinterland. And when Wormold has to present drawings or renderings of these mysterious military installations and draw sketches of the huge military equipment that he says is there, he uses drawings of vacuum cleaner parts in his own store as a model, but on a superhuman scale to look outsized and threatening. Wormold's successes electrify his MI6 superiors in London, and they want to further reinforce the success of this super agent. So they send reinforcements, especially Beatrice Severin, an assistant for Wormold. She'll function as his secretary, but in fact an assistant in spying. It's at this point that matters take a serious and dark turn, as the stories Wormold had concocted now take on a life of their own, with those whom Wormold had named as his spies now turning up in reality dead, and Wormold himself targeted for assassination by foes unknown. At this point, Wormold confesses all to Beatrice. He's fallen in love with her, and she seems to him real as opposed to the unreal world of espionage he's blundered into. Wormold disavows the, quote, patriotism or the preference for one economic system over another, end quote, as motives in a global war. Love or hate, he insists, should be personal. Quote, if I love or if I hate, let me love or hate as an individual. I will not be 59200/5 in anyone's global war, end quote. As Wormold concludes, quote, would the world be in the mess it is if we were loyal to love and not to countries, end quote. Wormold is finally, miraculously, able to save himself, his daughter, and Beatrice, leaving for England. But the story has a last absurd coda. Once back in England, rather than being punished for his outrageous deceit by MI6, he's actually given a job as a lecturer to train other spies, because revealing the fraud would just be too embarrassing for the bureaucracy itself. Similar personifications of disenchantment with traditional loyalties and reflections on the Cold War as a confusing wilderness of mirrors, as the CIA counterintelligence guru James Jesus Angleton had called it, are also on view in the subtle works of British author John le Carré. That name is actually a pseudonym of former MI5 agent David Cornwell. Le Carré was born in 1931 to a family run by a difficult father who, it turns out, was a confidence man. Le Carré was inducted into British military intelligence on being drafted into the army just after World War II, and he interviewed displaced persons in the refugee camps of Western Germany. After studies at Oxford, in the 1950s and 60s, he worked for MI5, then for MI6. The novels of Le Carré that really made his name are probably The Spy Who Came In From the Cold of 1963 and Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy of 1974. In The Spy Who Came In From the Cold, Alec Lemus, the British station chief in Berlin, becomes involved in an elaborate scheme to undermine an East German intelligence chief. Lemus is allegedly fired from his job. He comes in from the cold, out from under his cover operations. And he agrees, allegedly, to become an agent for the East Germans, and then gives them information pointing to Western agents in the East German intelligence service itself. However, the plan seems to go awry, as a young woman named Liz Gold, with whom Lemus formed a relationship in London, gets dragged into the affair. After the East German intelligence service has been damaged by suspicions and accusations sown by Lemus, and a key promising young official has been discredited, Lemus and Liz Gold are allowed to escape and directed to a spot on the Berlin Wall where they can get across to the west. But it turns out to be a trap. Just as Lemus and Liz Gold are climbing over the wall, at the spot where the wire has been cut, the searchlights pinpoint them. The East German border guards begin to shoot at that moment when Lemus is at the top of the wall and is pulling Liz Gold toward him. Liz Gold is hit and falls to the ground on the eastern side. Now comes the decisive moment. Lemus realizes that the firing has stopped, that he's being allowed to escape, and that all he has to do is to simply drop over the western side and he will be safe. A British agent on the other side yells out to him, "Jump, Alec, jump, man!" Instead, Lemus hesitates a moment longer and chooses, and then slowly, slowly begins to climb back down onto the eastern side towards the dead body of his lover at the foot of the wall. The border guards are ordered to shoot, but they hesitate for a moment and then finally do shoot. Two or three shots hit Lemus as he glares all around like a blinded animal. At the decisive moment, Lemus has come in from the cold emotionally and connected to the human cost of the conflict in the arena of the Cold War. By the end of the story, Liz Gold and Lemus have been sacrificed by their own intelligence service for the larger cause. The entire venture of espionage is a dirty one, the book argues, morally compromised. As Lemus rages before his death, quote, "What do you think spies are? Priests, saints, or martyrs? They're a squalid procession of vain fools, traitors, people who play cowboys and Indians to brighten their rotten lives," end quote. In this game, agents on either side may have most in common with each other rather than their bureaucracies. In Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy, the novel focuses on the decidedly unheroic character of George Smiley, a retired counterintelligence agent who is brought in by the British intelligence to investigate whether there's a mole in the ranks of their service. Smiley detects the true mole, Bill Hayden, a former colleague and a friend of his, who had actually betrayed Smiley by having an affair with Smiley's wife. Hayden is killed before he can leave for the Soviet Union. According to many scholars, the character of Hayden is actually based on Kim Philby, the formidable double agent of the Cold War. Now imagine that. Here's the ubiquitous Kim Philby making another undercover appearance, even in fiction. So, in the final analysis, is fiction stranger than fact when it comes to espionage? A former Inspector General of the CIA, Frederick P. Hitz, has actually written a brief and elegant book entitled The Great Game, The Myths and Reality of Espionage, that considers just this question on the basis of his own experience in this field of work and reading in this exciting genre of literature. Hitz lets his readers make up their own minds, but for himself, Hitz concludes that, quote, "I would argue that in the technical world of espionage, the real genius of human inventiveness and creativity exceeds the human imagination," end quote. Spies have been a powerful presence on the silver screen, in cinema, as well as in literature. But films tend to push the fantastic elements of spy stories over a realistic, psychological portrayal of the secret world. Consider the Bond films. The first Bond film was Dr. No, released in 1962 and starring Sean Connery. This was the start of the most valuable film franchise in history, one which continues to this very day. In our own times, the 22nd Bond film was released in 2008. But as we have noted, the Bond films often have presented a different character than in the novels. Less dark and ironic, more an action hero with fantastic gadgetry. And in fact, there's been a long tradition of this emphasis on super technology in spy films and cinema, beginning with Fritz Lang's classic German silent film, Spies, or Spione in German, of 1928. The genre of spy films is so durable that it has produced its own spoof subgenre, as in the case of the Get Smart films, Leslie Nielsen in Spy Hard in 1996, or Austin Powers' International Man of Mystery. I must mention also another form of portrayal of spies, which is a sort of pure distillation of the view of spies as trapped in a conflict that has lost its meaning. That's actually a cartoon. The cartoon series called Spy vs. Spy, which appeared in Mad Magazine in the United States. In these comics, two absolutely identical spies, except that one is dressed in white and the other dressed in black, try to kill each other in outlandish ways with gadgets and hidden explosives, never achieving final victories, always in an eternal contest. The author of these cartoons was the Cuban exile cartoonist Antonio Proyas. Their intrigue was called by Mad Magazine Way Outrigue. What would become of the spy in a new world? As the Cold War was winding down, the world seemed to be changing in the blink of an eye. How would spying change in these times? We'll consider this question in our next lecture.